As we begin this evening, I'd like to start by giving you a chance to ask any questions or report a little bit from your experiences, if you've been following the instructions at home. Anything at all from last week or anything that seems relevant? It's nice for me to get some reports of how it's going, because then I know that I can, you know, try to relate what I say to what your experience is. Yes?
When I was trying to do the meditation on feelings, first I didn't feel anything, which is what was to be expected. But then next time I felt a fear, and it was easy to locate where it was, and then I was asking myself why I feel a fear, and then the answer was, I may have messed up my entire life. And then this brought a kind of panic reaction, as opposed to the mild fear that it used to be before. And also was the end of the session, so I was completely thrown off. And I mean, I realized that if it is the case that I may have messed up my life, then you can't tell that one. But if you just think of the actual situation. Do I consider this as a question that I have to look at, that, you know, go ahead saying, why do I think it's such a big deal if I mess up my whole life? Or do I consider this as a message from my inner depths saying that I, in fact, have messed up my entire life? What's next? So, I mean, there is this distinction here, that do I look at it as a fear or do I look at it as a message?
That's a good question. I think it's impossible to mess up your entire life. But it's certainly possible to mess up most of your life. But not to belittle what you're experiencing. There are various insights that can come to us as we meditate. You can sit and be quiet and be with your feelings and just feel it in your body, just be with it. And sometimes, because you ask a question like, you know, why is it there? Or just no question at all, just kind of certain things bubble up that suddenly you understand something in a new way, or new insights. And sometimes those insights, those understandings are, you know, right to the point and very, very significant. Occasionally there's very powerful, intuitive, seeming insights that are actually wrong. You can't always be sure that they're right. But sometimes they're right on the dot. And then the question is, what do you do about it? And it's really up to you. I think it's very important, if it seems like a very significant message that's coming, is to somehow or other stop and listen to it and pay attention to it. And for example, to go for walks and just walk and reflect and think about these kinds of things and different angles and try to understand them the best I can. What I also try to do is not to think about them during the meditation time. So I might have a strong insight that arises, and my dedication during the meditation is to stay with the mindfulness, not with the reflection and thinking about what it means, which is a different thing to do, a different practice, with the understanding that it's actually much more powerful and significant to learn how to be the observer, the neutral kind of observer of what your life experience is, rather than a participant. So if you start thinking about your experience, then you're a participant. But if you're just simply continuing with the mindfulness moment by moment, oh, now I'm afraid, now I'm thinking that, now I'm feeling that, now I'm kind of just staying kind of with what's actually happening, watching it, that's actually will help you become freer. And one of the things in your situation, what you'll discover, and this is kind of the depth of what the practice is meant to offer, is that if you can discover the ability to be the independent observer, in a sense, of life, then you'll find out eventually that that core of who you are, that independent observer kind of place, is not really affected by the conditions around you in the world. And the conditions around you in the world could fall apart. But you have some inner sense of well-being, some inner sense of security or happiness that you realize doesn't really depend on what happens around you. But if you stop and start thinking about it and how to figure it out and all that, then you've lost the chance to find that deeper place of freedom or security. That makes sense?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if all kinds of personality can do this, or...
Sorry?
If everybody, I mean, can everybody do this? Can any kind of personality just go and be in this observant place?
It takes practice. That's what we know. It's just, you know, it's the practice of mindfulness develops over time, and at first it's very difficult. And first, what often happens is first it's difficult to remember to do it. The mind keeps wanting to wander off. It's been said sometimes that mindfulness is very easy. The idea of mindfulness is very easy. The practice is very, very easy practice. What's difficult is remembering to do it, because the mind wants to wander off so quickly, you know, and gets lost in its concerns. And it's a spiritual path, which means not that it's full of glory and light, but it means that all of who we are gets churned up in the mindfulness. And sometimes what bubbles up is great difficulties. And sometimes what bubbles up is great joys. And sometimes, you know, one follows the other. And what you'll find with the mindfulness practice is that slowly, if you stay with it, you'll get a deeper and deeper experience of yourself. And as you go deeper and deeper into yourself, there are layers of who you are. Some of the layers which are quite painful and difficult, and some which are quite blissful and wonderful. And some people feel really lucky because they get the blissful layer right away. And, you know, boy, this practice is made for me, you know. But then they just have to wait a few years. And some people have the difficulty right off the bat, immediately. And they say, well, this is not the practice for me, you know. But actually, they're right on track. Generally, the attitude towards your experience in mindfulness meditation is whatever your experience is what's supposed to be happening, in a sense. I mean, it's not justifying it or finding meaning in it. Just whatever your experience is a place where your mindfulness needs to be. And it's appropriate for that to be there, and then to kind of try to develop your mindfulness with that. So if you find that you're, you know, tremendous panic and fear coming up, then take that as just being appropriate in a sense. Don't be critical of it or think it's a problem. And then see if you can learn how to be present for it in a wise way. And if you can't, then sometimes it's really helpful to find someone you can talk to or someone who can kind of do it with you. So we're just taking some questions from last week or about your experience if you're trying this practice at home. Yes?
I realized that you had asked us last week actually to feel our emotions after we meditated for a short period of time. And I didn't feel anything, but I had headache, jaw was tight, and starving. I felt everything physically, and I tend to feel everything physically and realize that I don't have the emotional before I have the physical. The physical comes first for me. But you kind of said you feel an emotion and then it leads into, you know, what's your physical sensation? But I couldn't identify an emotional sensation, and I generally can't in my life.
That's significant, and there are a lot of people like you who are kind of emotional illiterates. And there's a book called, right, Emotional Literacy. And the mind-body connection is very intimate, and sometimes it can seem that a mental or emotional event occurs first, and then a physical event follows, but it can go the other way also. And sometimes they often appear, they arise together. That if if suddenly someone went boo to you, you're kind of feeling fear and you're kind of contracting, would happen exactly at the same time. It isn't like one follows the other. But the way the instructions are, the basic practice of mindfulness is a practice of paying attention to what's going on in the present. That's all it is. But to make it a little bit easier for us, the instructions are pay attention to that which is predominant in the present moment. What happened when I first was introduced to this practice in Thailand, I was at a fairly noisy meditation monastery. It seems like that's a contradiction of terms, but that's the way it was. And the teacher told me to pay attention to everything. So I said, well, there's so much going on here, I can't pay attention to everything, but I'll just pay attention to the sounds. And I started trying to catch all the sounds going on in the monastery at the same time. And I just got a headache. And then I went back to the teacher and said, you know, I got a headache. And he said, no, no, you misunderstood. You're not supposed to pay attention to everything at the same time. You're supposed to pay attention, you're not just being, you know, polygamous. You're supposed to, you know, we practice serial monogamy in mindfulness. And mindfulness is a practice of serial monogamy, where you give yourself totally to one thing at a time. But you don't have to stay with that. So the basic instructions is, you pay careful attention to that which is predominant in your experience, that which is most compelling, that which is loudest in your own experience in the present moment. So we start with a breath, and we give some interest to the breath to make it compelling. If then a strong sensation in the body arises, just let go of the breath and let that be your experience, your meditation. If a strong emotion arises, then bring mindfulness to that emotion. And part of mindfulness of the emotion then is to notice how it manifests in the body. And we're not saying that emotions start first and then the bodily experience follow. We're saying when you're aware of an emotion, then also become aware of how it is in the body. If you don't have a predominant emotion, then you don't have to worry about it. Now, some people are not very much in touch with their emotions. And some people are very much in touch with their physical body, but not with their emotions. They can't put a label understanding what it actually is. And sometimes that requires developing some emotional literacy. And so, for example, there's all kinds of ways you can develop that. You can read the book, Emotional Intelligence, it's called, right? I don't know if that's the best book to learn, some of the details, but certainly the theory, the idea is there. But you can begin collecting words. Like, collect all the different words for anger. Anger, irritation, resentment, fury, wrath, annoyance. You know, there's a lot. You can probably pick a lot. And then begin seeing if you can find it in your own experience, those differences. You know, when you experience irritation versus fury, how are you experiencing it? How would it be different for you? And start doing people watching. Notice how it is for other people. Can you notice a difference, you know, between, you know, wrath and... And just kind of begin playing with the words and trying to identify any connection between your own experience and those words. It's an exercise to do. But generally in mindfulness, we trust the process. And generally, if someone is really not in touch with their emotions, it either comes from kind of an illiteracy, not having the vocabulary and the awareness. More often it occurs because a person is numb or blocked to that part of their life. And there's something about the emotions which is challenging or difficult or unacceptable to the psyche. And so I'm not going to pay attention to that. And now that's just a basic psychological fact for some people. In the practice of mindfulness, we're not trying to break down the resistance or break through anything to some other level. But as you do the practice in a careful way, just trying to be present for what your own experience is, with time, the awareness will expand out. And some of the walls will begin either dissolving peacefully or come crashing down. So when you're sitting, and if you find a very strong physical reaction going on, take a few moments and kind of try out a few different emotional words. Very general. Is it fear? Is it happy? Is it sad? And see if any of it resonates. And slowly you might find your way. Yes.
I have difficulty with my neck and shoulders, and I find that when I'm sitting meditating, that I often move to relieve that tension. And would my meditation be enhanced anymore by trying to limit that movement?
Do you have a medical condition there?
I have arthritis in my neck.
Uh-huh. If you have like a medical condition like that, it's hard for me to know what to advise. I mean, I'm kind of reluctant to advise then what you should do about it. But one of the principles of mindfulness is that you're supposed to become your own teacher. So my job is to kind of make myself superfluous, kind of give you the basic practice, and then through trial and error, you find your own way. So you might try for 1 week not moving and seeing what the consequences of that are. And you might find that it makes your arthritis worse, and maybe not a good idea. Or you might find that it's fine. You know, and you had some fear about what would happen, but it didn't happen, what you're afraid of. You might find what happens to some people, that by bringing very careful attention to the place where there's tension or pain, that in itself can be healing of it in a way that's very different than the healing that can happen if you, you know, stretch and move and things like that. It's kind of like, sometimes when we want to fix things from the outside as if it's a mechanical problem. You know, I want to stretch, that's sort of a mechanical problem. But the initial cause, for example, of some tension, maybe not yours, but some physical tension, for example, might be that a person is chronically stressed, chronically afraid, or chronically, you know, greedy or something. And if the only thing you're doing is stretching to relieve the discomfort, the underlying cause for it is still intact. But if you bring your careful attention to bear on that experience, then you can begin to dissolve or relax the underlying cause of it. And it's much more significant to do that than to do some kind of mechanical change. I'm not saying one way is better than the other. I'm saying what you should do is to explore for yourself and trial and error and see what is most helpful for you in your condition. But I would definitely give it a try to sit still. As a general rule, as a general rule, most people their meditation will develop a lot quicker and deeper if you hold your body still during your meditation. In a sense, that every time you move your body, the physical movement moves the mind, and so the mind, you know, stirred up a little bit. And if you want the mind to get quite settled, it's best if the body is kept still. And sometimes it's a challenge to do that. Yes.
Sorry, I missed last week, but I'm changing that address. But when you're experiencing let's say you're focusing on an emotion and it actually causes a bodily, you know, you need to cry or you laugh or whatever. How do you address that when you meditate?
If it seems like it's just a spontaneous expression, kind of pouring out of you. Don't inhibit it. Just let it come, and just be mindful of that. The tendency when there's a strong emotional reaction like that is to get involved with it, is to kind of lose the mindfulness. And the trick is to try to maintain the mindfulness while it's happening, while at the same time being uninhibited about it. Just let it come through. Crying, in particular, is often just a release, and this is a great place to cry. You know, a lot of people have cried in this room, and it's a wonderful thing to do. So you should feel permission if that's what's coming up. Just that's okay. Laughing sometimes laughing is kind of a release and just happens spontaneously. More often than not, though, laughing can bubble up kind of momentarily, but often there's a tendency of getting involved in it, and then that's what keeps the laughing going. But if it feels like just a spontaneous free flow of, you should get out of the way and just be mindful of it. Yes.
Well, when you were saying the thing last time about if you're aware of some emotion, you know, try to become more aware of it. My only thing I could be aware of was that I kept wishing I wasn't falling asleep. So my big thing was, how can I try to make it through this tendency to whatever it happened to be getting into that sleeping space?
Uh-huh.
So I just kept trying to look at that.
Great. So then you just notice desire, be aware of that. And then you might, as you're aware of the desire to kind of stay awake, you might notice some of the other things going on there. Some people have a lot of judgments about sleeping.
Right.
And so, you know, you hate this and it's really uncomfortable, and here's one more thing you're trying to do and you're not succeeding, and so there's all this extra baggage that we have about sleeping.
Yeah.
So bring your attention, look at all the extra baggage you have.
Yeah, I was kind of working with that from the time before, so I was kind of getting to not having a judgment about it. You know,
good.
Working with it, but not having a negative or a frustrated attitude about it.
And what you could also do in addition then is to just become the world's expert in what sleepiness feels like. Like it's the first time you ever really paid attention to it. And you're going to go in there and find out exactly what it feels like in the eyes, and where the, you know, where, what it feels like in the mind or in the cheeks, and just, you know, so you can come out of this meditation and you go home and you can write a 10-page essay, a guided tour of sleepiness, natural history of sleepiness, you know, and then that kind of interest, really studying it carefully. That's mindfulness, to really see clearly what's going on. It's supposed to be kind of wordless, kind of a wordless kind of exploration, kind of. The basic question we ask ourselves and is, what is this? What is this? What is this? You know. But you know, if there's some little words going in, I mean, the practice of mindfulness can also be a little bit playful. I mean, you don't have to have some strict idea of exactly what mindfulness practice is. It's okay to be kind of playful with it and kind of, you know. You know, as long as you're trying to stay in the present moment, then you can be a little playful. And if some question comes up, and you can kind of use that to help you poke around and be present. Okay, so as a preparation for our next sitting, I wanted to say this. Say that you're running, and you've been running for a long time. You've been running your whole life, and you're always looking for the right shoes to run in. And this friend tells you, "Try my shoes," and you try them, and they're a little bit too small and they hurt. And then you go to find another friend, and that friend says, "Try my shoes," and those shoes are too big, and you trip over them all the time. And you keep running, and you keep trying new shoes, and you keep trying new shoes, and none of them seem to work right. So, and finally, you get really angry. Those shoes are the problem, you know. And I'm always wearing other people's shoes, and I should just be myself, and you know, I'm going to get rid of all shoes and run barefoot, and really be myself, and express myself, and just find myself, and find my own feet, and just run barefoot, and then you know, I won't pinch my toes anymore, I won't trip, and it'll be really great, you know, just be myself. And so you do that, and it's much better in many ways, except when you stub your toe. And then finally it occurs to you, I don't have to run. So our thinking is that way. Or our relationship to concepts and ideas. Many people are kind of chasing after ideas and concepts and understandings and ideas of who they are and who they are in relationship to other people and what the world is like and, you know, what all these things, you know, all these ideas, great grandiose spiritual ideas, great political ideas, great personal ideas. We're chasing after ideas. And many times when we chase after what we think are things, chasing after money or status or cars or houses, it actually isn't that we're chasing after those concrete things. We're actually chasing after the ideas we have of those things. And, you know, it's very common in, you know, in psychology to talk about projection. And, you know, half the time, or maybe more, that you fall madly head over heels in love with someone, it's often just a lot of projection. Like when I fell in love on a 3-month silent retreat. It was great, right? This woman was there, and you know, we couldn't talk because we were in silence for 3 months, but she was over there, you know, and so I kind of looked at her, and you know, kind of, you know, we must have looked at each other either, so you're like, you know, but no one else was looking, no one else was supposed to be looking, so. So anyway, so I would have this. 3 months is a long time to begin to have ideas, and sure enough, I had all kinds of, you know. I don't get into relationships very, very fast, so it progressed slowly. And at first, you know, we're just, you know, hanging out with her and going out for a date, and then it got more serious. And then it took a while, but then there was a proposal, and then there was, you know, commitment was a little bit hard for me, so I waited a while, for, you know, but then eventually it was the marriage. And then, you know, and it was quite glorious, you know, in the course of 3 months. And then the retreat was over, and the finally silence was broken, and you can hear people talk. And the silence was broken the first time by people being able to ask questions in the meditation hall. Just, and so she was one of the first people to raise her hand and ask a question. And she had this really thick French accent. I mean, she was obviously not an American. And at that moment, my fantasy just popped. Because the whole three-month fantasy was all based on the idea that she was an American. I mean, I never thought about that. It never occurred to me that, you know, to even think about that. But suddenly I realized that she wasn't my fantasy. She wasn't what I had built her up to be. I was head over heels in someone who was a projection. You know, I wasn't really in love with her. I didn't know who she was. It was just an idea. So we chase after ideas. And then we have some ideas that don't work very well, so then we try to find another idea that works better. This, you know, this idea, this great spiritual idea didn't work for me, so I'll find another idea to kind of hold my life in and orient my life in and whatever. And it's also possible to stop running after ideas, to stop depending on them and looking for security in them. It's possible to relax and not have the mind running after anything, not to be concerned with ideas, concepts, thoughts, commentary, interpretations, judgments, as being the center point around which we orient our lives. And the sad thing is that most people orient their lives around their thinking. Some people think we are what we think. That's what defines who they are. What I think is who I really am. It's a very limited sense of self. Or what I think must be true. The opportunity in mindfulness is to stop running, is to step outside. Or to use the description I used earlier. You can either be a participant, caught up in the currents of your life, or you can be an observer. And you don't want to only be an observer, only be a participant, actually. But kind of temporarily, we'd say, it's possible to step outside of the currents of thinking and see that you're thinking. And that seeing that thinking is going on is not thinking itself. It's kind of like suddenly you can step outside of a very crowded room. You can go out in this big balcony where it's cool, and you can look back into the crowded room and say, wow, that's really crowded in there. It's nice to be out here where it's fresh and clear air. And I don't have to be involved in all those cocktail party discussions. I can stand outside and watch it all. And the reason why this is helpful is that it gives us some space to relax. When we're in the middle of the room, in the middle of all our thinking and thoughts, trying to negotiate them and figure out the better ones or resist them, whatever's going on, there's often very little room there for us to relax. So an important part of mindfulness is to learn how to be mindful of our thinking. Not to be thoughtful of our thinking, but to have this silent awareness, oh, now I'm thinking. And that silent awareness then allows us not to be so caught by them. And see, there's an alternative to our life that's, in a sense, outside or wider than the world as we negotiate through our thoughts and ideas. So we'll see. We'll do a sitting now, and perhaps you'll get a little sense of this. So take a comfortable but alert posture. Gently close your eyes. And then take a few moments to simply feel your body. Feel how you are right now. And then if the following instruction makes any sense to you, see if you can let there be a gentleness towards yourself as you sit here. A gentleness, kindness to your body, to yourself. And then with an attitude of kindness, take a few deep, slow, long breaths, using the sensations of breathing to bring you into your body, aware of it. And then as you exhale, relax, let go. Do that 2 or 3 times. And then let your breath return to normal. It can be helpful at the beginning of a meditation session to scan through your body, and then each time you exhale, relax some part of it. So for example, you might bring your attention to your forehead and your eyes, and as you exhale, let there be a softening there, letting go of any tension built up during the day. Same thing with the cheeks and the jaws and the mouth. And feeling your shoulders. Then very gently, as you exhale, let there be a softening with your shoulders. And the same thing with your chest. And in particular with your belly, it can be very helpful to have a soft belly as you meditate, letting your belly hang forward, relaxed. And then bring your attention to your breathing, feeling the way the body experiences the breathing. Perhaps you feel the movement of the chest or the belly. Perhaps you can feel the pressure or the expansion, tautness as you inhale, the release, the relaxation as you exhale. Some people will feel the air as it moves in and out through the nostrils. If you get a massage, I don't believe you get too much benefit from the massage by thinking about what the masseuse is doing. But if you can really feel the hands of the masseuse against your own body, the sensory experience, I think you get much more benefit. So in the same way as you are present for your breath, your breathing, it's not a matter of thinking about it or thinking about anything else, but it's a matter of sinking into the sensations, allowing for the rhythmic sensations of breathing to kind of be a massage of your body. Inevitably, the mind will wander off in thought. And that's okay. But each time you notice that that's happening, relax the thinking mind and begin again with the breathing. With a little gentle kind of emphasis of hanging in there with the breath. From one breath to the next. So the breathing works on you. So continuing for the next few minutes with your breathing, entrust yourself with the breath. Turn yourself over to your breathing and let your awareness rest there with each breath, breathing in and out. And then continuing with the breathing, kind of being with the breath in a gentle way. But each time you become aware of your thinking, whether the thinking carries you away or just you notice that it's also there, let your attention be with your thinking. Notice this phenomena called thinking. We're not interested right now in the content of your thoughts, what you're thinking, but just bring some very simple, generous awareness to the fact that thinking is going on for you. You don't have to stop thinking or push it away. You can very quietly name it, thinking, thinking. Most people pay attention to the content of their thoughts. But if you pay attention to the process of thinking within you, what do you notice? First, you might listen to the inner voice that does the thinking. What's the quality of that inner voice of thought? Is it very quiet and subtle? Is it loud and aggressive? Is it hesitant? Angry, sad. As if you were listening to someone else speaking. What do you notice about your own inner voice as you think? Is it neutral? Is it fearful or apprehensive? Impatient? Aversive? Sometimes thinking occurs effortless within us. And sometimes our thinking can be energetic. You can feel energetically the vibration, the tension. Sometimes you can feel like pressure. Sometimes you can feel a physical aspect to the process of thinking. If you allow yourself to think kind of freely, whatever happens, can you tune in to the physical, energetic aspect of that process? If you're very sensitive, you can be aware of the interest you have in your thoughts. There's thoughts which are occurring. Then there's the interest, the way of getting involved with them, reactive to them. And then go back again to your breathing. Let go of your thinking as best you can. And take two or three breaths and just really be with your breathing the best you can. Enter the breath. And then every time thinking arises, you get lost or carried away in your thoughts, let your awareness, your mindfulness, clearly and fully and directly see and acknowledge that thinking is happening. See the process of thinking, letting yourself kind of be the observer of the process of thinking. And notice what happens to your thinking when it's clearly seen, clearly acknowledged. And then for the last 30 seconds, just relax and don't do anything at all. No practice, just be present and quietly with your eyes open, eyes closed, I mean. One of the assumptions people sometimes have about meditation is that it entails having a silent mind, that you're supposed to stop thinking, that thoughts are a hindrance to the process of mindfulness. For mindfulness meditation, there's no need to stop thinking. There's no need to have an attitude that thoughts are a problem or a distraction from the meditation practice. It's possible to consider the thinking just just one more thing to include as part of the awareness practice. So when the body has strong sensations, we bring a meditative awareness to that. When there's emotions which are predominant, we bring a meditative awareness to those emotions. When thoughts arise, it's possible to have a meditative relationship to the thoughts. We don't have to reject the thoughts or get rid of them or stop them. You can just simply see them clearly and see them with this silent awareness that sees what's there. We can think, we have the ability of thinking, and we can know that we're thinking. We can feel something and know we're feeling. We can have a sensation and know that we're sensing. That knowing is kind of silent. It's not an added thinking on top of it. So, some people are kind of at war with their thinking mind when they meditate. There's no need for that. What you want to do is then very quietly and calmly acknowledge, be mindful of the fact that thinking is going on in the present moment. There's a cute thing about, a lot of times we think about the future or about the past. And since meditation is about trying to be in the present, some people think, oh, I have to stop thinking about the future and the past. That's bad, you know, I'm not in the present. Actually, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. In order to wake up in the present moment, you don't have to stop thinking about the past or the future. You simply have to be aware that thinking about the past and thinking about the future is happening in the present. If you can clearly see this is what's happening in the present, then you're doing mindfulness. The tendency for us is when we think about the future and the past, we get caught up in it and lost in the whole worlds we make. Mindfulness is to keep us from being lost and clearly see, oh, this is what's going on now. Now, if you're sitting here following your breath and your mind wanders off into your thoughts, and it's relatively easy just to let go of that, this kind of surface chatter of the mind, nothing very powerful, then just let go of it. Relax, let go, and come back with your breathing. But if your thinking is stronger than that, you can't just let go of it easily, then the practice is let go of the breath instead and bring your meditative awareness to acknowledge the process of thinking is happening. This is what's happening in the present moment. Kind of look thinking right on, head on. I'm thinking. Often you'll find that if it's relatively mild, that it'll just kind of dissolve by itself quite quickly. Sometimes thinking is quite strong, very, very insistent. And that's fine. Then you just have to keep a regular, persistent awareness of thinking as it continues through time. Just thinking, aware of that process. And if it's that insistent that it keeps staying, the thought thinking, then probably you can become aware of other aspects of the thinking. You can be aware of the energetics, the physical aspects of it, the pressure in the forehead or inside the skull, or the tightness in your jaws, or tension in your shoulders or in your neck, or sometimes you can feel like 10,000 bumblebees kind of flying around your skull all at once. Restlessness can be part of it. There's all kinds of things can be part of the thinking. And what you want to do is find something physical that you can ground your attention on so that you can be present for the overall process of thinking that's going on without tripping out on what you're thinking about, tripping out on the content of your thought. So when thinking is really compelling, you can maybe find some physical aspect of it just to hang out with, to help you be with it. Sometimes, as you start being aware of very compelling thoughts that are staying through time, or the same thought keeps reoccurring over and over, you can let go of it easily enough, but just keep thinking the same thing over and over and over again. Then what you can do is to look around a little bit and notice if there's an emotion which is fueling it. So, for example, if you find yourself planning a lot, you can let go of the planning pretty quickly, or maybe not. What you might find, 90% of the time you'll find, people find, that the planning mind is being fueled by fear, by apprehension, by worry. And if you just simply see the fact you're planning, you're aware of it, thinking, planning, but you don't acknowledge the fuel for it, the factory for those planning thoughts, the factory of worry will just keep spitting out more planning thoughts. It's kind of like the thoughts are kind of like this flag that's being waved up in the air saying, hey, you dummy, pay attention over here. And it says, don't pay attention to the flag, pay attention to the flag waver. And most of us pay attention to the flag, the thoughts that are being waved. Often, sometimes when we have very compelling thoughts going on, very really driving us, kind of obsessive, they're kind of like, we tend to focus on the flag rather than the flag waver. And what you want to do is drop down into the flag waver. What's the flag waver? What's really fueling it? And you'll probably find an emotional base for it. And then you do a mindfulness of emotions and hang out there. And if you're aware of the emotional base for your thinking, then there's no reason anymore for the flag waver to be waving, because the flag waver has been seen, and it relaxes. Does that make sense to you? Enough? So, what happened to some of you during the end of this last meditation, where I ask you to pay attention to your thoughts a little bit and discover something new about it? What happened? What did you discover?
Actually, I had a really interesting experience. This is the first time I've had it. When I was breathing, I had this thought in my mind that, you know, I jog a lot, so my legs were just, it was like as if there was a rhythm. And I was concentrating, and I was thinking I was actually breathing, but I was thinking of something else. And then I knew I was doing that. And then I thought of what you had said, don't acknowledge that, and you're acknowledging that. And then, so I stopped doing that, I tried to concentrate on breathing again. And then I thought my temple was pulsating. And then it's again in the same motion. And then I think I'm thinking that, and I stop that, and I go back to breathing. And there's always some kind of rhythm all through the, I don't know how much of a time this happened after. There was nothing else. I didn't think of anything else for the first time in my life. Nothing, except something. There was some motion that was cyclic in nature. I don't know.
So the thinking mind quieted down, but it was replaced or revealed some kind of rhythmic pulsing within you. Great.
I found that when the airplanes were going over, I started generating this story. And I started getting real hot and sweaty, and then you said to stop getting involved in the story and stuff, just think thoughts. And all those, I was getting all hot and sweaty, and it just totally disappeared. So it's really, but fear is such an interesting thing, because it's a bodily process as well as a
the mind creating a scenario that isn't necessarily true, but you're trying to, it's like an overactive imagination. Mm-hmm.
Could be.
As well as
it could be. So what you witnessed, I believe, is you saw how thoughts can generate an emotion.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing to be afraid of, but you had a thought and an association, a memory of a month ago, and all these things, and all that constellation of thinking, then gave birth to an emotion. So as the mind gets quieter and more observant, sometimes you'll notice that your emotions are rising out of thoughts. And sometimes, if you're quiet and sensitive, you'll notice it going the other direction. That emotion seems to come up first, and that emotion then seems to produce thoughts. And it's very empowering, very helpful to see the chain and effect, the cause and effect relationship between the mind, the body, the emotions, and the physicality, the thoughts and the body, the thoughts and emotions. Because then we tend not to be so caught by it if we see the cause and effect relationship. If, for example, if a person gets lost in their imagination and that produces fear, then what often happens is we compound those two, we conflate them together, and because we're so lost, caught up in our fear, we tend to give some credence to our thoughts. They must be true. But if you can see that various imaginary thoughts arose first, and then later came the fear, then you're more likely not to believe the fear. Just, oh, that fear is product of imagination. So another hand, please. Could well be.
I guess that's how I would experience it.
So that's fine. You know, and the thing about falling asleep in meditation, just continue the meditation the best you can. Don't worry about it, falling asleep. Just try to do the best you can and try to be mindful of what's happening, be mindful of the sleepiness, and try to be present. Sit up straighter a little bit to kind of get some more energy going. Open your eyes if that helps you stay more present. But don't consider falling asleep a problem or a hindrance, or it just, you know. I remember when I was in the monastery, I used to fall asleep a lot in meditation. And, you know, I'd be sitting there very, you know, minding my own business. And then I'd go. And once I was the... In the monastery, there was the bell ringer for ending the period of meditation and all that. And the monastery actually had a very big bell. Like, you know, it was literally this huge bell, right? We had a little bell like this for ending the meditation, but for various kinds of services and ceremonies, we had this big bell. And since I was supposed to ring the bells, I was sit, you know, for the end of the meditation session, I was sitting in front of this big, big bell. You sit right in front of it, right? It's like this far away. And so I was sitting there, you know, minding my own business. Bung! And everybody knew Gil had fallen asleep. And the most amazing thing, to my credit, shows how relaxed like I was and unconcerned what other people think about me, and I did it twice in one sitting. And so then, and then after a while, I stopped falling asleep in the monastery. I said, "What's wrong with me? I'm not relaxed enough to fall asleep." Don't worry about falling asleep. Don't worry about not falling asleep. The idea is just continue your practice the best you can. And if you're asleep, be great. And if you discern that you're sleep deprived, then, you know, try to change your life a little bit. Please, how was that to do with that little exercise, noticing your thoughts?
I notice sometimes that all of a sudden after my mind has been wandering, and then I try to bring it back, that I'll have this really heightened awareness of my hearing. All of a sudden, I notice that the room seems really quiet, almost as if there had been a fan on or something, and now it's off.
Great. You're doing the practice. The practice is to notice. You're noticing something. It's great. You don't have to, then look at any tendency you have to assign meaning to it. That's extra. Yeah.
I found, in addition to starting to that, having muscle spasms from trying to sit well still in the midst of pain. My mind always just incessantly races and it's exploding all the time. I had some bizarre thoughts that I don't really normally have. One seemed to be like a sudden anatomical look at the inside of the nasal passage or something. Cadavers then. It's just like very, very disconnected. I didn't hear the plane. I was focused on the person that was breathing loudly. The other thing is that I didn't hear the plane. I hear it now. I have the overlay that I hear coming up a lot during the question period of the shoulds and the should not. So that I wish there was a different way of almost of asking questions or phrasing things, because I feel so burdened by another layer of shoulds and should nots and supposed to be and not supposed to be, and it's a really thick layer. I'm wondering if maybe some of my early brief exposures in the early 70s to some different type, well, maybe more of a Hindu tradition or something, but where the mind is empty space, you know. There's just I don't know how to talk about this. Just another layer of shoulds and supposed, or are we supposed to do this, or does this mean I'm doing it wrong, or and so I feel like I'm beating myself up all the time. The idea of not moving the body, of being perfect, trying to be perfectly still, it's almost like that perfection. I don't even know what I'm supposed to be doing, but I always feel that pressure that there is a right way, and I'm not. It doesn't seem that there is a right way.
That's great.
I just hear a lot of this, also other people asking the same: who's supposed to be or should, and is that a good way of asking questions? Is there a different way? Is this from being children who are supposed to, you know, you're supposed to clean your room, you're supposed to do your homework? What is this about?
Well, for some people, it's pretty innocent. They're just trying to learn the basic practice, and But sometimes we bring along with us this extra weight of this, you know, it's almost religious kind of shoulds and shouldn'ts and right and wrong, and you know, if I just get exactly what this guy's talking about, then I'll be safe, or I'll get it right, I'll get a star, or, you know, then I'll be in the in crowd. Yeah. And that's a very important thing you're pointing to. I've known people who got involved in spiritual traditions, in Buddhist practice, for example, for years and years, and we're kind of trying to fit themselves into the Buddhist box. You know, what's supposed to happen when I practice? And you look around, and you know, how am I supposed to act? And that person had that experience, and that person gets a lot of approval from the teacher. So maybe I'm supposed to have that experience. And how do I kind of huff and puff and change my mind? And it's just a dead end to do that. So I'll tell you another wonderful story. When I was just beginning to start a regular meditation practice, I was doing Zen practice. And I was going to college at the UC Davis, and there was a little Zen sitting group that met twice a week in someone's little bedroom. There were like four of us that sat in this little bedroom. And in that particular tradition of Zen, you sit with your eyes open, and you sit facing a wall. Now, there's a small bedroom, so the wall was right at my knees, you know, sitting like this. And I was sitting there meditating, and suddenly in front of me, there rose this majestic Roman column, you know, massive. The kind of thing you see in front of banks that reassures you the bank is really stable and solid, right? Just massive, you know. And written down in this huge column was these letters and big, solid kind of engraved letters with painted black kind of was Z-E-N. And at this point in my hallucination, I'm not sure where the hallucination ended and where reality came in, but this was my experience, was that I then proceeded to embrace this big column. And as I embraced it, it vanished. And one more time, my head hit. And, you know, some people are slow to learn, you know. They have to. But that got my attention. And what I realized I had done was I'd made Zen or Buddhism this great authority figure. And that what I was trying to do in studying being a Zen student was to try to understand Zen, this, something external to myself that I was supposed to master, understand, and get, and become, and whatever. And that experience taught me, no, it's not about Zen out there. It's about me. It's about becoming aware of my own experience, being present here. So I forgot about Zen. And then it became a real turning point for me to then just trying to be more present for what my own next life is. So there is a kind of a should in mindfulness, unfortunately. The should is, you should pay attention. You should be mindful. But what you're mindful of, and what your experience is as you're mindful, is completely open. You can do anything you want. So it's helpful to sit up straight. It's helpful to close your eyes. There's all these things which are helpful. So the instructions of mindfulness is not a should. It's these are what we found that are helpful. If you don't find this is helpful, find something else that is. If sitting with your eyes open is more helpful, if, you know, all kinds of things. So whenever you hear a should, for me, hear it as, this might be helpful. Okay. This might be helpful for you. And if it isn't helpful, let's talk about it some more. Maybe find something else which is helpful that helps you simply be more present for what your own experience is. I don't want to be in the situation of wanting you to have any different experience than you're having. Even if you came here with the most god-awful headache, it's not my job. I don't really want you to have a different experience. What I'm trying to do is help you to know how to really be mindful of that without being non-reactive to it. So there's a kind of should there. You should be non-reactive. But, you know, you will be reactive. It's guaranteed. The practice then is to notice that, be aware of that, in a non-judgmental way, best you can. So there is a kind of little bit of attention, little bit. The other thing that points out to me is that when we sit down to meditate, we sit down to be still, quiet, and attentive to what's happening in the present moment, we tend to bring with us it's kind of like it becomes a microcosm of the rest of our life. And so if you have a tendency when you come to meditate, to shoulds and shouldn'ts come into operation, chances are very, very high that tendency is operating outside in other areas of your life. The advantage here in meditation is that it's really good for it to happen here. This is like the best place where your shoulding and shouldn't could happen, because here you can start really addressing it and seeing it and understanding it. Yes?
Well, there's this really funny saying that I saw on a greeting card, and it said, if you can't learn to do something well, learn to enjoy doing it badly.
So, when I asked you to pay attention to the tone of the inner voice, the quality of the inner voice that does the thinking, For how many of you that makes some vague sense to you? And since very few of you are willing to talk here, I take it it was embarrassing to find out what. Any of you want to say something about what you discovered? It's not always so clear, the difference.
Yeah.
And if it's not so clear, don't worry about it. Just again, you be careful with shoulding. The practice is really to be mindful of what your experience is, what the best you can. And don't be ahead of yourself thinking, well, I'm supposed to separate it out. And just you know, try to be mindful of what's most obvious and what's really going on. And then you find your way slowly.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that knowing feels like a lot of thinking. It's like an extra burden.
Can be. Sometimes there are ways in which we do mindfulness which is a little bit off, which adds a little extra burden to ourselves. But mindfulness is self-correcting because you're supposed to be paying attention to what's going on. So after a while you find out, oh, I'm trying too hard. And oh, trying too hard makes me kind of actually a little bit of tense. You relax. Or maybe you find out you're trying to be really relaxed. And after a while you find you're always falling asleep. And it means I'm too relaxed. And so, because you're paying attention, there's a way in which the practice helps you correct and find your way. Yes, last one, and then we're going to sit again.
Oh, yeah. Well, I found, some of it I was having, and I sort of gaining the ability to be accepting of whatever as I went through different states, you know. Some of the time, thinking, but I didn't feel like I was getting really caught up in it, and then so I was finding a nice sort of a way of making it through the different changes, whatever, you know. And then here and there would be a little bit of a period of feeling extra aware, which was I was really kind of feeling, wow, this is a quite a more aware feeling, but then I didn't get hung up that if I couldn't stay in that place.
Great, very nice. So, take a comfortable, alert posture. And take a couple of slow, long breaths. And as you exhale, settle into a stillness within you. Relax. Let your breathing return to normal. And be aware of the sensations of your body, sensations of your mind if it's racing, the energetics of just being here right now. Relax your thinking mind and settle into your breathing. Letting your breath relax you. Or if you're sleepy, sit up straighter and let the breath awaken you. If you emphasize the inhalation a little bit, it's more awakening to be with the breath. If you emphasize the letting go of the exhalation, it's more relaxing. Each time you exhale, let go of your thoughts. Occasionally, it can be helpful to ask a question during your meditation. And a useful question can be, what needs to be accepted right now to make it easier for you to be present, mindful? So thank you. And so next week is the fifth and last week of the introductory course. And as it turns out, it doesn't look like I'll be able to be here next week. So I've invited, there's a small chance I will, but probably I won't. And I've invited a senior student who teaches these classes elsewhere to come in and teach the last class in the series. And then I'll be back in 2 weeks. And sometimes in my mind, I consider the week after the five-week introductory course as just the sixth week of the course. So if you want to get, you know, one more day of the course with me, then we can just come back for the sixth week too. And I'll build on what we've said so far. And if you don't come back, then I thank you very much for coming for this course, and I wish you all a wonderful week.